Now, there was a decrease in the administration of what's called electroconvulsive therapy, otherwise known as ECT, in mental health centres throughout 2020. According to the Mental Health Commission, it has found that overall compliance to the rules and code of practice relevant to ECT increased. The administration of electroconvulsive therapy in approved centres activity report 2020, that's the name of the report, outlines how often ECT is used. The people who receive it, the services providing it, and the quality and safety of the service. To tell us more indeed about that now, we're joined by the CEO of the Mental Health Commission, John Farrelly. Good morning, John.
Morning, Claire. Thank you
for joining us this morning. You're very welcome. Now, I was looking up this issue on the electroconvulsive therapy and what it was yesterday, and I got onto a page, the American College of Psychiatry or whatever else. It's a reputable page, not something that you find randomised on the internet. And I wanted basically to understand what exactly electroconvulsive therapy is and what is it purported to do. You might just give an overview if you can.
Okay, so electroconvulsive therapy is known as ECT, and it's a medical procedure and it must be prescribed by a doctor. So what would happen is that you would go down from the unit or the ward on a trolley down to a theatre like you were going for a normal operation. There's two nodes applied to your head. You're put under general anaesthetic and you're also given a muscle relaxant. And what happens is there's a small amount of electrodes put through your brain. And what will happen is, if your listeners can think, if they put their hands out in front of them and just shake their fingers very slightly, that's exactly the reaction you would have. And the doctors and the anaesthetists will be looking at that. They'd also be tracking the monitors. And they see that little reaction, they know that the therapy is working.
Yeah.
Sorry,
John, because the word convulsive is the emotive word in that particular... That's just my reaction.
Yeah.
When I see electroconvulsive therapy, I tend to think electricity, electric wires, driving people into convulsions. But the website I was referring to says that it involves, as you've outlined there, a brief electrical stimulation of the brain while the patient is under anaesthesia, and is typically administered by a team of trained medical professionals that includes a psychiatrist, an anaesthetist, and a nurse or physician assistant. And it goes on through the risks, benefits, etc., etc. Back to your own report in terms of it. How widespread of the use is it, or is the use of it in Ireland?
So it's going down in Ireland. So if you imagine that we have 66 approved inpatient mental health centres. Only 14 of them use ECT and 5 of them refer, and most people refer into St. Pat's, which is a centre of excellence. But in our area, for example, Naas does provide ECT, as does Port Laoise. Last year there was only 5 people received ECT in Naas. Generally, it's going down in that there was only 300 programmes of ECT around the country last year, given to 239 residents. And I suppose the reason, there's a couple of reasons for this. Number one, the improvement in medication and holistic therapy, so that we're able to, when people have a significant mental illness, a depression or mood disorders are the main disorders that happen here. We have other ways now of bringing people out of it, because in fairness, people tend to use the ECT as either a maintenance for people who they know medication won't work for. And Clem, I can't understate this, and you just tipped on it there with electroconvulsive therapy. There's a huge stigma around mental illness and things to do with getting treatment for mental illness. And so, and this happens in terms of ECT, or if you think of the name schizophrenia and how that's used in a derogatory way.
Yeah.
So really what we're beginning to see now is there's a lot more treatments available. I suppose what caught my eye about this, and I was surprised because I was as badly informed as many people are now about ECT. I just assumed, like others, that it was an outdated Victorian treatment.
So did I, actually, John. And, you know, many of our perceptions of ECT are informed by films, horror films, whereby somebody's strapped to a table, there are electric wires pinned to their heads at various parts of the bodies, and then we see this absolutely terrible convulsions. But it's important we point out to people that that is not the way it goes. Because according to your report, John, on page 10, I see the board reported in 2019 depressive disorders were the most common diagnoses recorded, accounting for nearly a quarter of the admissions to inpatients' mental health services. Schizophrenia, schizopodal, and delusional disorders accounting for 21%, etc. But on that theme, John, about the very negative perception of ECT, go ahead.
Yeah, it's just that people have that, and yet what it is it's a medically prescribed safe procedure. I actually saw one, and with the anaesthetist, the doctor, pretty much you're going under general anaesthetic. The other thing which I think is amazing is, I don't know if anyone has ever known anyone who's been significantly depressed. Now, I'm not talking about under stress, etc.
Yeah.
I'm talking about significantly depressed where you can barely move, you can barely eat, and I think some of us have seen people like that. And where that's intractable, where medication won't work or it's a long time, ECT, and from us talking to the doctors and the patients, we could see ECT was a lifesaver there. That said, it's used rarely enough around the country, and it's on the decrease.
2,329 individual treatments administered in 2020, a 25% decrease. You've explained that the decrease maybe is attributed to improved medication that can be used as an alternative, and ECT then. Am I to infer from what you're saying that electroconvulsive therapy is reserved for extreme cases of depression or schizophrenia where medication is not working?
Yeah, it is. But that said, the vast majority of people, 80% do it, are prescribed it voluntarily so that the patient wants it and the doctor feels that, yes, they qualify for it. But there's also a percentage, and this is where we regulate and monitor and why we put the report out to assure the public. There's a percentage who don't have the capacity and are so unwell that they're not able to give their consent. And in that case, there's strict rules around it, and that a number of doctors must approve it. There must be rigorous evidence as to why it's going to occur, and it must happen within the rules. So there still is an element there that we have to watch carefully. But overall, the people that do, the 239 residents who wanted to receive it, I think 190-odd of them were doing so voluntarily.
All right. With the CHO Area 6, which is the region that we're talking... Well, we're specifying our own region here. It's actually not 6, it's 7 I want to go to, which is CHO Area 7, a population of 702,000, covering Kildare, West Wicklow, Dublin West, Dublin South, City and Dublin South. Over the years of 2017, 2018 and 2019, I'll just deal with 2019, the acute psychiatric unit in Talla Hospital had 38 treatments of ECT. The Jonathan Swift Clinic at St James Hospital had only 4 treatments, and the Lakeview unit in Nace General Hospital had 11 treatments, 17 the year before and 14 the year before that. Given the extent of mental health issues in this country, John, the numbers, I think, reflect that it is used more on the conservative extreme side than as, obviously, not as a general, you know, thing to do.
Yeah, very conservative and very extreme. And this is for inpatient, very conservative side. Yeah, it is. And look, you know, it is an option. It's a treatment option. But what we're trying to push across the line is medication is a treatment option, but so are talking therapy, so are support, so is care in the community. Many of your listeners, look, if you think about Nace, and I will even say Portlaoise in this area because it's down on the border, and Nace unit uses Portlaoise some nights. I think many of the listeners will remember when none of these services were available, when there was just an institution that people would go into and they were detached from their family. Now what we're seeing is that when you get a mental illness, it doesn't mean that you're detached necessarily from your family, but there are services there. Not that the services need to improve, Clem, I've said this 100 times, but at the same time, the dynamic around mental illness is changing. And I suppose just to emphasize that when someone has a mental illness, as we all know, if you think of our worst day, multiply that by 100 for depression, you know, as people know that most people with a mental illness, and there's this stigma out there, are people who are struggling, who are suffering, who need help and need support.
Indeed. It's a very extensive report, John. I've been through it. And on page 17, the demographics are interesting because it says approximately two-thirds of residents in 2018 and 2019 were female. You know, that's a rather large, and I know you're not a medical doctor or whatever else. It's just simply these are the statistics being reflected in it. And one of the other areas that I'd like to talk to you about and maybe address, what about the area, well, just the average age of residents who were administered ECT in 2019, your report says, were 59 years of age in both 2018 and 2019, and ranging from 23 to 89 years in 2019. Or in 2019 even. So right across the age cohort demographic, it is being administered, but as we say, in a low amount of numbers. What about the area of consent, John, which your report deals with? Who actually gives consent, or who can give consent to allow what is, let's face it, while it's designated a safe treatment, it is on the extreme side. So who gives the consent for that to be administered?
Okay. Okay, so there's checks and balances there. First of all, any medical treatment should really, it's only in exceptional circumstances, things should happen without a person's consent. So what happens is that the person, if a person can't give consent, the doctor may be recommending it, another independent doctor must look and decide and recommend if it's required. A lot of people get confused about this, and funny enough, we're setting up the decision support service about next of kin and family, etc. That's not how it works. Someone else can't give consent for someone else. What we have is a procedure in place where the doctors must look and make sure, first of all, that it's needed, and then you have an independent doctor when the person can't give the consent themselves.
Now, a very important section of the report says, and this is on page 20 or thereabouts that I'm looking at, yes, it's the outcome at the end of the programme of ECT, and your report reflects that improvement was reported as the outcome in 87% of programmes of ECT done in 2019, a slight reduction from 92% the previous year. Complete recovery or significant improvement was reported as the outcome at the end of the programme for 63% of programmes. So only 2% of programmes reported deterioration. Obviously, John, then you would maintain, would you, that those statistics justify the continued use of electroconvulsive therapy?
Well, I'm very conscious that also, and we, so this is the doctors specifying this rather than the patient. So there's for me, I'm very conscious of that. It seems to, from our report and our stats, we're kind of putting it out there for transparency and to assure the public. But it seems to be very effective in the 239 people who've used it. But that said, I would recognise that I have met people and service users who've had ECT, who didn't like it, didn't think it worked for them and would never use it again. So I think you have to have a balance. We haven't quite got there in Irish society yet where there's an equal voice for the professionals and the service users. But on balance, you would have to say that it looks like an effective treatment.
All right. In terms of compliance, which is very, very important, that the rules in place about the administration of this are being adhered to, your report indicates that in 2018-2019, the Inspector of Mental Health Services inspected 15 of the and 16 approved centres, respectively, across those years. In 2019, of those 16 approved centres, the rules were not applicable for 5 centres, as they only had voluntary patients. And reasons for non-compliance for both the rules and codes were similar, included patients not being informed of the right to access and advocate cognitive assessments. Would you be concerned about that, John, that even though it's a very small number of cases, that in some cases there is not compliance in terms of patients being included in the decision?
Yeah, I would be concerned about that, and that's something that we follow on up with in each centre. And it comes back to the cultural change that's happening in Ireland. Very often people think that it's a medical procedure, it only concerns a doctor, an anaesthetist, etc. And that is true for the medical procedure. But they also understand that we also need to understand that the patient themselves or the person themselves may want to speak to an advocate, get some advice from someone independent who knows more about the kind of the socio the sociological things and the psychological things they'd be worrying about. So they tend to get forgotten about. Now, it doesn't mean the treatment is going to be any less effective or that it's dangerous, but what it does mean is that there's a little gap there in terms of vindicating people's human rights. It's a small gap, but it's one that we would want to close.
Indeed. On that note, the purpose of publishing the report, according to John's Mental Health Commission, is to provide an assurance to the public that this medical procedure is regulated and monitored by John's organisation, the Mental Health Commission. It's very important that people have an understanding of this, because given the prevalence of depression in this country, and as John pointed out at the outset of the interview, serious depression where people are practically disabled, unable to communicate or to move, such is the depths of the depression. Often, this particular procedure, which I didn't have a full understanding of until I read this report, because the term electroconvulsive therapy can be quite alarming, but hopefully you all have a better understanding of it now. The report is the administration of electroconvulsive therapy in approved centres covering those years that we talked about, 18, 19 and 20, and CEO of the Mental Health Commission, John Farley. John, maybe wish you a very happy Christmas, and thank you for facilitating a variety of interviews with us throughout the year.
No, thank you. And can I just say, as a Raheem's man and out here in Cara, the best of luck to Nace and well done to Nace, and I hope they do well in the championships for the rest of the year. Talk to you.
There's nothing like sporting ecumenism. That's until the championship starts, of course, within the county. Then we'll deal with that. John, well said. Happy Christmas to you and all in Cara. Thank you indeed for your time this morning. All right, you can keep your messages coming, please. Does ECT diminish the mental abilities of the patient? Mick in Kildove says, no, it does not, Mick. And according to this report, in fact, the improvement when it is administered in those cases of extreme depression, schizophrenia, the improvement is quite dramatic, according to the report. And that's that report done by the Mental Health Commission, based on the data returned by doctors. So we can only rely on their general expertise. Ciara.
Joined now on the line by Athy Councillor Mark Lee for Labour. Good morning, Mark.
Ciara.
Mark, we're going to begin with your question to the council, asking them in conjunction with An Garda Síochána to run a campaign. This is to highlight the speeding issue in the town of Athy.
Yeah, it's a constant. It keeps getting reported to me here as a councillor in the town. The speed of cars going out some of the side roads off Main Street, you know, like Woodstock Street, the Monastrevin Road, Carla Road, Castle Dermot Road. You know, we have some infrastructure in place on some of those roads, speed ramps and that, and we don't have on other roads. But that's not kind of what the motion was about. It was more of an idea, if we could put our heads together to see can we come up with a strategy to slow cars down.
And Mark, in terms of the countywide speed limit review, have you put anything forward for the main street of the town?
Not on the main street, because the limit of the main street will probably stay the same, Ciara. It'll be in around the 30 kilometres an hour. But unfortunately, cars aren't heeding it. So I think it's a pent-up impatience of going through the town. There is traffic problems in Athy. The new road will solve a lot of this. But as soon as they get a little bit of open road, they're putting the boot down and heading out, regardless of what the street. Now, people on Woodstock Street have been, in particular, very concerned as soon as cars are turning the corner there, that they are putting the boot down. And there is a pedestrian crossing, we know, at the Amber service station there. But there's a fair distance between the top of the road and there. So they're getting a good run at it.
OK. You asked the council to confirm the up-to-date position with the provision of sight lines at Killeen Lane. That's in Kildangan.
Yeah, and we got a bit of work done on a lane there. It was a community involvement scheme, which basically means that the community puts 15% of the money towards getting the lane done, and the government will put the rest of the money there towards this. Lovely job done by Kildare, the county council, and our own road section, but there is a problem with the sight lines coming out. The road engineer at the meeting said there is a planning problem there at the moment, and as soon as that's cleared up, he will look into getting it solved.
Okay, you asked the council to write a letter. This is through Athy MD's Cathaoir Lock to the insurance ombudsman. This is outlining the discriminatory issue of companies not insuring properties in the Barrow region in South Kildare, where flooding has never occurred.
Yeah, I had to bring this one to a motion. I felt it was a waste of a motion, to be honest with you, but that's the rules. There are the rules. I've been on with Clem and Owen and yourself, Ciara, a number of times over this during the year. Insurance companies are basically walking off the OPW plans, and they are discriminating against houses that are in the floodplains, I think. We have one house, as I have mentioned before, 45 years home insurance, never a problem, never flooded, and it was added to the OPW map this year, and now they can't get insurance. Row of houses in Ribbon Manor, there at the back of Ribbon Manor, same kind of a thing. They're 23 metres away from the Monine stream. It's never flooded in anybody's lifetime up as far as the wall, even that's between the houses and the river. They can't get insurance either.
And Mark, I'm sure you weren't surprised by what the council said in the report, that the core of the motion obviously relates to insurance cover, and those issues are outside the council's remit. So yeah, how do you go forward?
Well, what I've asked to do is for the Cathaoirleach to write a letter to outline our concerns as councillors. Maybe they'll listen, maybe they won't, but at least we have it out on the table that these are our concerns in South County Kildare.
Mark, just finally and briefly, please, you asked the council to confirm if any conservation works are due to take place on the medieval church. It's fenced off in the St. Michael's Old Cemetery area.
Yeah, from my limited research, Ciara, this church has been built in 1297. Unfortunately, it's covered in, by the St. Michael family, sorry. Unfortunately, it's covered in ivy, and there's building barriers around it for a number of years now. And I have asked, is there any plans to maybe consolidate the building at least so people can visit it? You know, Athy is becoming a tourist town. There will be a huge amount of traffic, tourism traffic in the next few years with the Blue Way, etc. And things like this, protective structures, I think we need to consolidate them, get ready. And now what I've asked to do is that we have a new community monument funding that we can apply for as the council up to 85,000. Hopefully the council will apply for it in January.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Mark. Enjoy your Christmas.
Thanks, Ciara. Happy Christmas to you and all your listeners.
Thank you so much, Mark. Take care. Hi. That's Mark Lee, Labour Councillor for Athy.
Thank you indeed, Ciara, for that. Now, in just a moment, we'll be talking fire safety for Christmas, because it's very, very important. Just like Halloween, people often forget at times. You know, the slightest little bit of carelessness can get you into trouble. Just in response to that last item there, about time the speeding in Athy was highlighted. Offaly Street is dangerous. Someone will die if it's not managed properly. Thank you, says a listener. I'm in agreement with you, listener. I don't know who sent that particular one in, but I have to say, I'm totally in agreement with you. The traffic up and down from Emily Square out to Offaly Street, out to Carlow Road, they're treating it like a racing track. And that's likewise the traffic coming in from the Carlow direction along the Carlow Road down towards Offaly Street. It's like a bloody racing track. And what I can't understand is why we see the camera speed vans on places where, like, for example, about a mile or two out of Athy, outside, I think the farm is owned by McManus's, you find your man or your one, depending on who's in it, they're practically permanently on one of the straightest stretches of road that you can get. But yet, in places like the Carlow Road and down into Offaly Street, I never see a sign of anyone doing a speed check. Some child is going to get run down, because that section of road, about a kilometre of it, in total maybe less, has up to 1,000 houses feeding onto that road, and they're treating it like a Formula One. I agree. Sorry for the rant anyway, but there we are. Now, let's talk fire with this, because I'm joined by my sister, Chanel Ryan. Good morning, Chanel.
Good morning, Clem. How are you?
Of course, we're not related, just in case they'll think, oh yeah, bringing the family on in regards to that. Now, Chanel, very important time at Christmas in terms of what's going on regarding fire safety. And we have a number of things here that I want to talk to you about. Let's talk, number one, smoke alarms.
Yes, hugely important, hugely important. We can't emphasise that enough. It's the core of our fire safety campaign throughout the year, really, is smoke alarms, and just to make sure that people have them, that they make sure they check them, that they're working. I suppose we have a tendency to forget about them when they're up on the ceiling, and we don't hear them very often. And I suppose on that, I mean, if you are hearing them very often, it can sometimes indicate that you've got the wrong type of smoke alarm fitted that keeps it, creating false alarms or whatever. So, you could look into getting a different type of alarm. There are two different types. One is slightly more sensitive than the other, so you could just maybe look at getting the other type.
Okay. You're obviously a better cook than I am, then, that your smoke alarm doesn't go off that often. But you're right. And we can test them. I really forget to test them at times. Stick the handle of the brush up onto the button and see if does it trigger them. Everybody do that. Now, Chanel Ryan, Kangles. Bloody Kangles. I know we're getting more and more battery types, but this is a time of year when there are candles everywhere and highly dangerous.
Highly, highly dangerous, yeah. Unfortunately, we have had a couple of fires recently that were caused by candles and candles being left unattended. They're a huge source of concern to us. You basically have an open flame in your room and in your home. So you need to take it with extreme care and make sure that they're never left unattended, they're not left on surfaces that can catch fire, they're not near decorations, they're well away from Christmas trees. And again, similar to your smoke alarm, it can sit there and people are unaware that this hazard is there until, obviously something comes into contact with it or the heat spreads from underneath it and can catch fire. So huge risk within the home. And like you say, this time of year, it looks lovely and they're very festive and, the shops are awash with candles at this time of year. But, we just have to always try and exercise caution. And again, if you can buy or you can afford to buy the LED ones, obviously they give the same effect.
And they're nicer actually, and they don't they don't even give off the black smoke that can blacken your walls and everything else.
Exactly.
So
yeah,
folks,
yeah.
Candles, keep them away from curtains, Christmas cards, keep them away from them, remember it's paper, keep them away from, never leave them unattended, and never go to sleep at night with the candles on, as Chanel is pointing out. Safety. Now, another area that's highly dangerous, Chanel, are Christmas trees.
Yeah, I mean, both real trees and artificial ones. I suppose the real tree scenario we can face, and the danger there is that they dry out and they become highly flammable once they're dried out. If you do have a real Christmas tree, make sure you have a water stand and keep your water stand watered regularly so that the tree can get the moisture out of that, because once they dry out, they'll go up in no time. The artificial ones then, safer in the sense that they can't dry out, but you have to make sure that you're buying a proper tree, that it's CE marked, that it is, it's not flammable, it's not the flammable type. Again, keeping them away from any heat sources, just so that, they keep safe, and make sure that the lights, again, are CE certified, that they're, proper lights, that you haven't bought them cheaply off some website or whatever, because, you're kind of playing with fire, pardon the pun, absolutely,
Yeah, but it's the thing people don't realise about Christmas trees, the real ones, that they dry out and they can become a huge fire risk in terms they could go up. And now, by the way, don't ever try to burn your tree after Christmas, like break it up and whatever.
It could cause
serious fires. I'll come to the area of chimneys and other things. I just want a word also on decorations, because people often place decorations too close to whether it's candles or fireplaces, etc., Chanel, do they?
Yeah, that's it. And try and keep them away from open fires or stoves. I know Christmas, it's nice to hang the stockings by the fire, not when the fire is being lit, because obviously that's a huge heat source there. And people, I suppose, are also under the misconception that, something needs to be beside the fire or close to the fire for it to catch, to be actually in contact with it. That's not the case. Fire radiates, and the heat can go out. So sometimes something that's not even particularly beside the fire can start to, kind of smoulder and combust itself, even though it might not be anywhere near it. So, we always say keep at least 4 feet away from heat sources.
Don't put the decorations near the fireplace, please.
Exactly.
Or even hang them too close to the mantelpiece. And the mantelpiece also can be dangerous. Don't leave stuff hanging down over the fireplaces. Yeah. Christmas tree lights, Chanel has already referenced them. Buy only reputable ones. They can be a very serious fire risk. And switch them off before you go to bed. And speaking of going to bed, Chanel, electric blankets.
Yeah, we're probably seeing less of them, to be honest. I suppose maybe the houses being a bit warmer or more energy efficient, people, I don't know if they go so much for the electric blanket.
Well, I do, Chanel Ryan. I do. How very dare you? I have a lovely one with three settings on it.
Well, for you. Yeah, look, it's something we rely on, we ignore, we take for granted. Strip down the bed and have a good look at it, front and back, to make sure there's no scorch marks visible on it. If you're storing it, if you don't use it over the summer months or whatever, roll it and don't fold it, because the folds cause the wiring to kind of pinch.
Didn't know that now, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, see, there you go.
No, that's a useful bit of advice. Roll the blankets, store them.
So just keep them rolled. And then again, when you go to use them again, just give it a good look over. Plug it in before you put it onto the bed, just to be sure that it's, you know, it's, and there's no smell coming off it, or, you know, where you can smell burning or anything like that. And sometimes you can see that scorching, maybe where a wire is starting to, maybe lose its... coating that's on it, and it's coming into contact then with the actual flammable.
I have to say that I love mine about 5 o'clock in the morning, when I generally wake up an hour before I have to get up. It's just turn it on, but factor three, and there we go. Yeah, but it's very serious. They are things we completely forget about them, out of sight, kind of out of mind.
Yeah.
Finally, Chanel, chimneys.
Yeah, we have Santa coming now in a couple of days, so
that's
he likes clean chimneys. I suppose we always notice an increase in chimney fires when the weather gets colder, and we've had a particularly mild winter to date, so our chimney fire rates aren't as high as they would normally be. And again, look, complacency, people probably think, sure, I haven't lit the fire as much or whatever, but, you know, we would recommend cleaning the chimney at least twice a year. And, you know, sometimes Christmas is a nice trigger for people to remember, OK, I'll get my chimney clean now because it's coming up to Christmas. But again, you know, they are one of the most preventable fires, you know, a build-up of soot and debris in a chimney. I mean, once it's cleaned, that risk is gone. No, not eliminated, but it's genuinely significantly reduced, you know.
So, folks, we want you to watch these for Christmas. Smoke alarms, check them. Candles, keep them away from everything. Use the LEDs rather than the lighted ones. Christmas trees, they dry out, can be serious fire hazard. Add water underneath them so they can stay moist. Keep your Christmas tree at least a metre away, 3 feet away from any heat source, and dispose of it properly, of course. Decorations, nowhere near heat sources. Electric blanket, except for Clem's one. Maybe not to use it too much or whatever else, but I do like my comfort, I have to say. Spark guards over the fires. Chimneys to be cleaned for Santa. We don't want him getting dirty. And final word, very briefly, Chanel. Every year at Halloween and Christmas, we have incidents of people's clothes catching fire because they stay too close. I think you have some kind of motto in the fire service of stop, drop and roll.
Stop, drop and roll, yeah.
What is that?
Well, it's just, if your clothes catch fire, I mean, obviously people will panic, but the key is just to stop what you're doing, to drop down onto the floor and roll, and it helps to extinguish the flame.
Okay, on that note, and very sensible advice, stop, drop and roll. Please have a happy and safe Christmas, everyone. And particularly to you, Chanel Ryan, and your team in the Kildare Fire Service, who do such a great, great job to keep us all safe right throughout the year. A very happy and safe Christmas to you and your colleagues.
Thank you very much, Clem, and the same to yourself. Thank you.
Thank you indeed. Chanel Ryan, Fire Safety Officer with the Kildare Fire Service.